Hi, I am Frank Turner, and this is my splash story.
Frank Turner has the 10th studio album of his career, Undefeated, just about to come out. And I have to speak to the guy about it. Frank, how the devil are you? You wonderful, wonderful man.
Well, after that introduction, I'm much better than I was 30 seconds ago. And it is always a pleasure to speak to you, man. So thank you for having me. How are you?
I'm very good. It's funny. My dad used to have an expression when he was speaking to someone that he really wanted to speak to, that it's always a pleasure and never a chore to speak.
Well, yeah, there we go. I like that. That's good. It's never a chore, for sure.
Let me tell you that, ask you this, right? You are just about to start the promotional sort of thing for the Undefeated album. And I just wonder, how do you feel at the moment? I mean, is it excitement? Is there nerves? What's going through your mind?
There's a melange of stuff. There's nerves. There's always nerves when you put a new creative thing out into the world. There's the weird imbalance of the fact that I've spent 2 years working on a record that's 44 minutes long, and some people will listen to it for 44 minutes or possibly less of their life, and they will go, yeah, that's all right. And I go, but it's my life. But that's how it works. So there's that. And then, there's nerves. I mean, I'm slightly kind of physically bracing myself. This is set to be a really, really hardcore campaign, I should say. Working with a new label setup this time around, which is lovely because it means there's more international scope on this record than there has been in the past. So I'm having conversations about going to South America and Singapore and, you know, places like that. So, there's a bit of nerves. But mainly excitement and kind of sort of surprised relief is quite a big part of it. I mean, you know, I'm aware that it's quite unusual to promote a 10th album. Not many people get to do that. And people still want to talk to me about it. I'm not kind of like angrily refusing to quit in my bedroom and talking to my three fans on a Reddit thread or something, you know. Not that there's anything wrong with that, I should hasten to add. But like, you know, it's increasingly what I do is sort of so far beyond any sort of templates that I had as a kid, if you see what I mean. Like, that it's just sort of, I feel increasingly like Wile E. Coyote. I've long since run off the cliff and I'm still in the midair and I haven't fallen down yet. And that's a really lovely thing.
Does there be any more pressure on this release when the last album went straight in to the UK charts at number one, which was a wonderful day? It was brilliant. And it felt like we all won that. Do you know what I mean? That
yeah,
all the fans together, you know.
But thank you. That's kind of you to say. It was a strange day. It was a strange day. And funnily enough, I had a chat with a few other people who've been in a similar situation. The guys from Don Broco, Mogwai, people like that. People who've done a kind of like outsider usurpation campaign for the number one. And everybody agreed. It's like, how did you feel when you get it? And the answer is exhausted and quite keen to go home and go to bed for a bit because it's sort of manic. This time around, I mean, it's funny because like, it's also worth saying that like my whole identity as a kid, like in the 90s, was I was the kind of person who didn't care about the charts, didn't know what was in the charts, didn't listen to the kind of music that was in the charts. That's, you know, the music industry has changed. The world has changed. And I'm not in any way complaining about the fact I can tell people I'm a number one artist, man. But like I was slightly conflicted about it. And in some levels, the fact that we did it last time does sort of take the pressure off a bit this time around. It's just kind of like, cool, we did it. Let's move on. Having said that, you know, having moved recently, as I sort of alluded to, from working with the major label world back into the independent world, I was quite keen to see if we could do it again. But then Taylor Swift announced her album like the week before mine. And I've got a feeling that that counts me out of the running this time around, which is frustrating. But again, it's also kind of a relief because it's like, you know, well, there's nothing anybody can do. Taylor Swift's like the weather. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's just, there's not a huge amount of arguing to be done.
I should add, sure, we thought you were going to be over there doing a duet with her. No, is that wrong?
I mean, I wouldn't say no, but thus far, my phone calls have been unreturned. I will say that I'm a huge Taylor Swift fan. I think she's a songwriter of a generation. I think she's amazing. And I think that a lot of the flack that comes her way is so transparently chauvinist, it's sort of almost not worth commenting on. But nevertheless, you know, we operate in different universes, shall we say. And I wish her all the best, not that she needs it from me.
Only this was a record that it's so personal because you recorded it at the home studio that you and your partner have created over the last sort of while. It just even more. I mean, how did that change how you worked on this record?
I think there's a fair amount of kind of reclamation, might be the word for this, the process of this album. You know, kind of again, moving to a different setup was quite liberating in its way. I have a new drummer in the Sleeping Souls. This is his first time recording with us, and he is just unbelievable. He's like a toy. You wind him up and he does anything. Like he's so good, it's sort of laughable. I've produced myself, which wasn't something I was really ever envisaging doing. I really enjoyed doing it. I felt really in full kind of creative control of the process. It's not to say I feel like I should have done it every time. I didn't have the skills before, but I built the studio to record other bands, which I've been doing for the past 3-4 years and, you know, sitting in the producer seat. And, which incidentally I love. It's a slightly different type of creativity, but it's an amazing kind of, it's quite reinvigorating working with lots of younger bands who are full of piss and vinegar. And, you know, it stops you feeling old and jaded. That's the theory anyway. I just sort of felt like I knew exactly what I was doing when I wrote the album. My band and I rehearsed it for about a month or so. Then we went into the studio, and by the time we were actually pressing record on stuff, it was almost just a process of documenting what already existed in my mind in a way, you know, and using obviously the amazing skills of my band who are all phenomenal and incredible and all the rest. But, you know, it was easy, dare I say it, to make this record. You know, I live by the beach and we were kind of swimming in the morning. It was last summer, and then going into the session and tracking, and, you know, it felt like a breeze. It was really nice.
What's lovely is I now know where I'm going to, reduce my spoken word album.
Yeah. I wouldn't recommend swimming in the winter. It's a British beach, you know, chill out. But in the summer, it's very nice.
Tell me this, Frank. Do you ever have a situation, though, that you can sort of, when you are producing it, you know, writing the songs, that you can sort of step outside the project and look at it as a whole? And also, you know, because it was recorded, you know, at your home studio, were you able to have a point when you said, the album is finished, I don't need to tinker anymore?
Well, I mean, first of all, in terms of stepping outside it, I mean, that's the thing I think that every artist tries to do while they're being creative in any form of creativity. And of course, it's impossible on some levels. You know, in some ways, I'm the worst person to ask questions about this album. Thank you very much. Lovely interview. See you later. But do you know what I mean? Like, I'm far too close to the project in some ways to have any sort of objectivity of it. I mean, one of the nice things over the years of doing the kind of 10-year anniversary shows for albums that I've been doing in recent years is that after 10 years, I do get to listen to a record. I don't listen to my own records because I'm not a sociopath. I do get to listen to my records before the 10-year anniversary show and have a degree of arm's length objectivity, which is kind of interesting to me. You know, I'm like, ha, there's some interesting choices on this album. Maybe I would do it differently now. But anyway, so, you know, you do try. I think it's a useful exercise to try and sort of think about something holistically, try and see it from the outside, but ultimately it's a losing game. So there's that. In terms of, sorry, I've now forgotten what the second part of the question was.
Listen, what I was going to ask you about now, actually, was the first song that we got to hear, which I believe is on the album, is No Yes. Thank You for the Music.
Yes.
And yeah. I was wondering I loved it in that it was, it just suddenly, I got an email, I think from the fan club or whatever it was.
Yeah. Yeah.
Said, new track. You can download this now. And I was like, couldn't believe it. Why did you do it like that? And why did you choose that song in particular to be the first introduction to this new record?
Well, I mean, the first thing is, like, you know, you do a kind of big album and announce and launch and a first single, that kind of thing. But it's a nice thing to just sort of the people who are dedicated enough to, for example, be on a mailing list or whatever, to kind of make people like that sort of feel included as well. And there's different types of songs on any given record, and there's some that the songs that might be your first foot forward from a kind of, let's say, radio point of view aren't necessarily going to be they're not the same as necessarily the ones that might be kind of like fan favorites or whatever. Again, I'm the wrong person to judge this, arguably. Nevertheless, so I mean, one of the things that this record has, when we finished tracking it before we'd mixed it, but we had rough mixes, I played it for my wife and she says, you know, it sounds like you guys are having fun. And it hasn't necessarily sounded like that in a while. Which, let's leave that begging question hanging. you know, there is definitely, there's a bit of a kind of sense of kind of like, there's a confidence and there's a brash kind of like, chest out kind of vibe here and there on this record, which I quite like. You know, hopefully as ever in a slightly self-deprecating kind of way, you know, I don't want to be too up myself, but, you know, and like that song, hopefully it's a kind of hymn for kind of like people who are engaged in and find their identity in underground culture. That's essentially saying, I don't really give a fuck about what the mainstream thinks about what I do. I never really did, you know, and I still don't. Throughout my career, there's been people who've kind of questioned whether or not what I do is like relevant in some way, as if giving a fuck about relevance in music was anything other than the most lickspittle bullshit. You know, so it's got that. I mean, I should say I've had the song title "No Thank You for the Music" in a notepad forever, and it's kind of sarcastic and fun.
It's going to be a rock and roll version of the ABBA songs.
Well, I am a huge ABBA fan, and I will. Here's a brash statement for you: if you don't appreciate ABBA's songwriting, you don't know about songwriting. They're one of the greatest songwriters
of all time. Completely agree.
Nevertheless, this song has more to do with, let's say, the Wild Hearts than it has with ABBA, yeah. Should we say? But I'm also a big Wild Hearts fan, so there we go. You know, it felt like a kind of a cool first foot forward to kind of show people the general kind of mood. I mean, it's a broad album. There is introspective stuff. There's a country song on the record. There's a solo folk song on the record. There is a kind of hopefully a broad spectrum of mood and music on there, but this is quite, you know, it felt like we're starting here. This is where we're kicking off from.
The next track I want to speak to you about is Do One, you know,
yes.
which is lovely. I'm because I know that Frank Turner has listened throughout the world, and I'm wondering where people in South America will get Do One.
Yeah.
it's brilliant. It's absolutely brilliant.
It is. I mean, the title came last. I mean, I had the song and I was like, what are we going to call this song? And then a while ago, my side project band, Mingle Hub, we did actually discuss being called Do One at one point because I just thought it was a hilarious name for a band. It then occurred to us that that's not a thing that, as you note, is necessarily going to translate outside of a particular form of British English slang. Do One, mate. It's because of the nature of the chorus having the do-do-do sing-along thing. It just struck me as the most kind of like, again, you know, I hope it's clear that I don't take myself enormously seriously all the time. Sometimes, you know, there's some serious work here and there, but like, it's fun. That's a song. The funny thing about that song for me, and this has happened more than once in my career, like I'd sort of finished writing the album and I'd started talking about it to people, not necessarily kind of like press or promo stuff, but you know, to my wife or to my friends or whatever, what's the record about? What's the general vibe? And there's a moment where suddenly I realized that my rhetoric was in place, but the album wasn't quite matching up to that rhetoric just yet, and there was a need for an extra song to kind of like fill out what I was telling people the album was about. You know what I mean? It's like, it's about this, and it's like, oh, it's not quite yet. I'd better write another song. So I started that one together. I wrote the song very quickly. I wrote it in a hotel room in New Zealand. I was in a room next to my tour manager, and the walls were quite thin, and I was kind of toying with it, and I was recording a solo version on a voice note on my phone, which is generally what I do as a first draft of a song. And it took me maybe an hour to get it right and to get it finished in this voice note. And the second that I sort of completed a run that I didn't screw up and sort of thought to myself, yes, that's my work for the day done, my phone buzzed and I got a text from my tour manager from the next door room just saying, good song. There was an immediate vote of confidence in there, which was nice. But again, you know, it's a song about, you know, self-respect in a way. There's a bit of a fuck you to that song. You know what I mean? There are people, I've had my share of slings and arrows thrown in my direction, and it's a bit of a song saying, hey, fuck off, I'm still here. It didn't work.
Now listen, I'm gonna throw a name at you here, right? When you mention the Beatles, right? Everyone is, you suddenly go, but the first band I ever heard singing a song in a different language other than their own was the Beatles, when they had I Want to Hold Your Hands and other songs sung in German. And you've done the exact same with Do One. And it's just incredible that you've done that. And also, I just thought, is that not the biggest mind fuck to be able to get together, you know, ever?
Yeah, it's tough. I mean, let's see, it's funny you mentioned the Beatles. It was more of a thing in the 60s that bands would record different language versions of their songs, and people come and go with it over the years. I'm actually later today working on the Spanish language version, and we've got a French translation coming in, and I'm attempting to persuade somebody to do Portuguese as well. It's really fun. It's a cool challenge. It's a nice, it's a bit of respect to people as well. I've got to the point now, I don't really speak German, but I do my shows in Germany, all my between song banter is in German these days. It's rehearsed, quite a lot of it's written down on bits of paper on the floor. But it's a way of just kind of tipping your hat to people and acknowledging that you're a guest and all the rest of it. So it's fun. The problem I have with the German Do One version at the moment is that Germany, the German label and German press and stuff seem to have gone a bit mental for that translation, which is great. But the problem is they now want me to sing it live on like TV shows and radio and stuff. And recording it in the studio is fine because you do one line and then you press stop. And then you rewind or whatever, and you do it again. But I now have to learn the whole bloody thing. And there's 20 lines of lyrics in that song, and I'm currently, I'm pleased to say, 12 lines in.
So how are you saying? I speak German a bit myself. Do you say "do one" in English and just let them ride with that, or do you translate?
The do's are in English. I mean, I suppose it could be you in German. I didn't, I don't know. I didn't do the translation myself. My friend Ingo, who's the singer in a German band called the Do Nots, did the translation, which means it's a proper translation. It's not Google Translate or whatever.
Es
gibt Leute, die dich hassen, egal was du auch tust, is the first two lines. And I'm confidently assured that this means what I think it means.
I love it. I absolutely love it. Now, listen, starting very soon, Frank, is the touring cycle for this new record. And what I love about your career, right, is that you always doff a cap to people and you play shows that you maybe wouldn't usually do. For example, right? You've got in mid-May, you're going to be in Madrid, in is it Chambéry in France, touring with NOFX, their last ever tour. You've got bands like Circle Jerks playing. You've got bands like Grade 2, The Meth, all playing on that bill. How important are those two shows going to be for you as a person and as a musician?
Oh, well, so NOFX are a band that I grew up with, and they're really foundational to my taste in music and I think to my songwriting. I mean, I think Fat Mike would probably be slightly disappointed for me to harp on about this, but he's an amazing songwriter. contrary to his punk rock don't care image. He's a good friend of mine these days as well. I'm very pleased to be doing some shows on their farewell tour and, in some parts of the world that I have visited less than others. So I'm excited for that. I mean, I love touring. We are going to tour the shit out of this album. We have plans. We've announced, as we're speaking now, we sort of announced the first leg of like 20 legs. We've got UK run. We've got a European run. We've got Canadian run. We've got an Australian run. And then, as I mentioned earlier, hopefully we're going to hit some other parts of the world as well. So there's an awful lot of shows incoming, which is great and fantastic.
I've just been looking on the website at May 23rd, see you in Harrisburg, which is sort of the start of the undefeated US tour, and I mean, God, it's 22 dates in about 26 days or something, or something like that.
Yeah.
Your relationship with the States, I think, is really, really interesting because they've taken you to their hearts. You do very well over there. And it's so, so different for British musicians to go to the States because it's a totally different thing. You could literally tour there, for 3 months and barely make it, inroads. You know what I mean? But you've really gone out there. What is it about America that you love? But also, I think you're able to look at America and think, yeah, that's strange, especially with regards to politics and some of the stuff that's happened.
I mean, there's something totally archetypal about America. We all know the class sung about it, that like if you grow up in Europe or the UK or whatever, then you are inundated with your, with American culture as a kid, whether it's TV shows, films, or music. And just to pick a specific example, my taste in punk rock has always lent to the American side of that tedious argument over the years. So, you know, you watch Almost Famous as a kid, or you watch documentaries about kind of bands touring in the States, and there's just something so totally sort of classic about an American tour bus traveling, you know, down the freeways in the Midwest and blah, 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 blah. I love America. It's huge. It's super interesting. It's much, much more complex and interesting country than I think a lot of people, a lot of armchair Americanists in the UK who've like been to New York for a weekend. It's just like, fuck off. Yeah. Like, you know, it's a huge and vast place. I often think it's, you can say that like any one statement you can make about America, the exact opposite is also true. You know, there's lots of fat people in America, but then, I mean, Christ alive, go to California, you know, or whatever it might be. It's such a varied and interesting place. And I often think that like countries, I'm aware that I see this through the prism of who I am and the way that I travel there, but like my experience with Americans, they have some of the best manners in the world, contrary to the stereotype. Like I'm often shamed by how polite Americans and considerate Americans can be. Of course, everything happening right now in America politically is pretty relentlessly depressing, and I find it quite heartbreaking almost, because I really do love America, and I have friends. I mean, I want to say I have friends across the political spectrum in America, and I kind of do. I'm not sure how many full fat MAGA people that I'm on enormously brilliant terms with, but nevertheless, you know, it's a very country, and I think there's something slightly tragic about what's happening to America right now, and I do worry about it, both in terms of America and my American friends, and indeed obviously global politics as well. So who knows? And we're getting a tour in before November. So
yeah,
fingers crossed.
Ben, I wonder if you knew about this. I've spoken to Frank about this before, but it was quite incredible what he did. Was the 50 states in 50 gigs tour, which was, I mean, just unbelievable. And when we look back, you know, at your career, I wonder, what was that like? And I saw the itinerary for it and I wept because I thought to myself, my God, this is unbelievable. What was that like?
I mean, awful, grueling and terrible. No, I mean, it wasn't awful. It was great. But like, it was physically utterly, utterly brutal. We actually made a documentary about it that's coming out soon, I believe. It's like a four-part kind of behind-the-scenes thing on doing 50 states in 50 days. I'm the third person to do it ever, and I now know why, which is that it's a fucking nightmare.
You won't be doing it again.
my guitar player said, 50 states in 50 days for 50 years, once a year, and I was just kind of like, I mean, among other things, I'll be in my 90s by the end of that, so no thanks. It was tough. It was really tough. And like, I'm really happy that I've now been to all the states. There's a fair few that I'd actually like to go and spend a bit more time in, not least Hawaii. We finished in Hawaii we finished in Hawaii and everyone sort of said, oh, amazing, you'll have a holiday. And I was like, I've been away from home for fucking ages. I have to go home and see my wife. So we were in Hawaii for about 36 hours and it was my first time and thus far only time there. And it seemed lovely, and I'd love to go back and spend a bit more time, but we'll see if we get there over the years.
I've got to send you something, because you were talking about the different languages and stuff earlier on. There's this artist who's a virtuoso ukulele player called Tai Mei from Hawaii, right?
Mm-hmm.
She's played with Eric Clapton and everybody, and she does a song where she dresses in the style of each country and sing the lyrics in them with the ukulele. I'm going to say,
oh, wow.
All right. You've got
absolutely. That's very
And
impressive.
When you go there, she's absolutely top of the list to go check out, man.
I more than 36 hours and I'll see what I can do.
Listen, me being an Irishman, Frank, you know that I'm a big fan of St. Patrick's. And well, my goodness me, sir, this St. Patrick's, you are playing in Orange County and Las Vegas. They're called the Shamrock Rebellion shows, okay? But we've got some bands that are on this bill: Flogging Molly, Buzzcocks, the wonderful Skinny Lister, and then also as well, No Bro, who are, I think, if that band aren't going to be one of the biggest bands in the world in the next couple of years, I'll be shocked.
Yeah.
that must be something that you're looking forward to so, so much.
Very much so. Flog and Molly are old friends of ours. My first American tour with my band was opening for Flog and Molly in 2010, and we've been bosom buddies ever since. They're such a wonderful bunch, and we're proud to be on the bill and all the rest. I have to say, the fact that we are playing after Buzzcocks is fucking ludicrous. I'm such a huge Buzzcocks fan, and like, I'm generally a bit nervous about that, actually. Like, it's going to be wild. And then Nobro, incredible. We also have Nobro and Lost Evenings in Canada later in the year. My friend Steve from the band Pup turned me onto their music about 6 months ago, and I have been mainlining it ever since. Amazing band. But yeah, those shows, I mean, it's kind of the kickoff of the year. We're doing South by Southwest Festival and then heading out for the Shamrock Rebellion and stuff. And it's a nice way to start an album campaign.
One of the interesting things it was actually something that Flogging Molly are doing, is that they are playing a show. I think it might be online or whatever, and they're going to be concentrating on two different artists, one being Sinead O'Connor, the other being Shane McGowan, who we lost in the last year, both Irish artists and stuff. And I watched, I don't know whether you've seen it, I watched the Sinead O'Connor film about that was on just after she died. And she was someone who made a stand constantly through her career. And I think you do that as well. You make a stand. If you see something that you don't feel is right, you talk about it. You bring up issues in song and with your fans that maybe other artists don't. Is that something that you are very proud of in your career?
Yes, I think it's important to qualify a little. I mean, first of all, I'm a huge respecter and fan of Sinead O'Connor and indeed Shane McGowan. In terms of kind of like activist stuff, in my old age, he said with a rolled eye, the thing I've kind of like honed in on is that like, the causes I tend to support tend to be music adjacent, but with a broader implication. Let me explain what I'm talking about. I do a lot of work, for example, with a charity called Able2 UK, who talk about disabled access at live music shows. Now, the thing is, if the conversation is live music shows, live music venues, touring, all that kind of thing, I'm on safe ground. I know what I'm talking about. Like, this is a thing I understand, and this is a cause that I support, is improving disabled access to live music, and Stay Out Late's campaign that gets people with learning disabilities to come to shows with kind of gig buddies. We've supported them as well over the years. So, you know, now obviously it's clear that I think that disabled access is a broader issue than just gigs. And that integration of people with learning disabilities into society is a broader issue than just gigs. But gigs is the bit that I know about and that I can talk about with confidence. I'm very sort of wary of being one of those slightly kind of like rent-a-god musicians who's happy to have an opinion or two on any given subject. You know, because ultimately the older I get, the more I realize I don't really know anything about anything. And I think that a little bit of intellectual humility goes a long way. But as I say, gigs is something I know about. So, yeah, there's a bunch of different stuff. Safe Gigs for Women. I'm wearing a Calling All Crows t-shirt today, which is an American organization that talks about sexual violence in live music environments. You know, that kind of stuff. Again, there's always a kind of broader implication to it because gigs is a small part of human endeavor. But at the same time, it's the bit that I definitely know what I'm talking about when it comes to that. So that's how it works out for me.
Frank, I want to go all the way back to you as, for me, it was when I was about 9 years old and I got into Status Quo, right? It was the first, and I sort of fell in love with music and I've stayed with it for that time. I wonder when you were that 10 to 13 year old boy, when you were becoming the person you were going to be, what's the music you were listening to? What was the first music that grabbed you by the shirt and collar?
I'm very pleased to say I'm wearing the jacket right now. Iron Maiden. Iron Maiden were my first love and they'll be my last. Do you know what I mean? You'll be able to pry most of my recollection out of my cold, dead hands before you get to my copy of Killers. There's a degree of first love involved in that, but I still think they're a phenomenal band. And also the thing about Maiden that I love and that is still relevant to what I do, there's not very much influence of Maiden in what I do musically these days, let's be honest with ourselves. But, Maiden have always been kind of like, fashion resistant. Do you know what I mean? There's something about that band that's just completely impervious to social trends in this way that I think is completely amazing. Do you know what I mean? They weren't cool when they started. They weren't cool when they were enormous. There's been a bit of an ironic cool thing going on with them for a couple of years, but they've sort of earned that because they're so completely and utterly fad resistant. And I just think there's something super cool about that. You know, they're just Iron Maiden. They've never been anything else. They never pretended to be anything else. They do what they do. I love their more recent records. I think Book of Souls is amazing. They've sort of become a prog band and they don't care what anybody thinks about that. And I think that that's respectable.
Do you know what I'm interested in, Frank, is how you went from Iron Maiden to sort of like the hardcore sort of punk. I'll tell you something that happened to me. I was like you, Iron Maiden, Kiss, that sort of thing. That was my thing that I brought up on. And I remember
Judas Priest.
Yeah. And I remember going to see a girlfriend was a fan of the band Big Country, right? And I said, well, will you come? And I said, yeah, I'll come. And I remember a band called The Wonder Stuff came on stage, right? And it was 1987. And I was thinking, right, I'm absolutely loving this. There's no big monsters coming out in the audience. Yeah. There's no sort of thing. But it started me on the road from learning about that band to learning about Senseless Things, Mega City 4, all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, yeah, sure. Great bands.
What was your connection to becoming what Frank Turner is, and who are the people who are influencing you?
My major signpost band on the level that you're talking about would be Nirvana. I was 13 in 1994. Kurt Cobain, essentially I started buying Kerrang and Raw and Metal Hammer and stuff like that because I was into it, and they would cover Nirvana a bit, and then I got really, really into Nirvana. I took Kurt Cobain's death quite personally because I'd just become a huge fan, and then he died, and I was like, well, but what? But anyway, so I was a huge Nirvana fan, and that opened a huge door for me because I paid attention when Kurt Cobain mentioned Husker Du and indeed Black Flag, and he called himself a punk often in interviews, and I didn't know what punk was. And at the time, I was in this sort of bedroom band with my mate Chris, and his uncle Simon knew about music. So me and Chris trotted off to Uncle Simon and said, "Uncle Simon, what's punk?" And he sort of went, "Oh my god!" And ordered us to go and buy the first Clash record and the first and Nevermind Bollocks, which we did. And then, of course, historically speaking, shortly afterwards, Dookie and Smash arrived. So, you know, I kind of switched horses pretty hard at that point and jumped onto the punk rock horse, if that's a thing. It's like, it's important to say this without any kind of sense of superiority, but there was a sort of filtration process. For every 10 kids who were into Green Day, maybe 5 would check out NoFX. And of the 5 who checked out NoFX, maybe 3 would check out Descendants. And then eventually you get down to one kid who goes out and buys a copy of the first 4 years by Black Flag. Which I did on the day of my grandmother's funeral, weirdly enough. I was wearing a suit, and I was 14, and I ran away from the wake and went and found a record shop in Exeter and went in and asked if they had any Black Flag. And the guy looked at me like he was having an acid flashback, but then was just like, I mean, we do. And he sold me a CD of the first 4 years.
Now, you mentioned a gentleman called Christopher. Because it's as if you're going to read my notes. I'll tell you why. Because during my looking at your career, I saw the rather wonderful Christopher and Francis Volume 1, right?
Yeah.
Which is, Ben, you have to watch it. You have to get the album because it's absolutely insane.
Yeah, we were talking about this earlier on. Yeah.
We were talking about it because I when you just see something that you didn't really know and you go, oh my God, I absolutely adore this. Tell us about that and then the release that happened in 2022.
Yeah, well, I mean, the first thing, it might be one of the slowest gestating records in history. I think we're giving Chinese democracy a run for its money. Chris and I... Yeah, no, I know. Hopefully it's better than that. not a high bar, let's
be honest. It couldn't
be worse. So Chris and I, we were friends since we were 3 years old. We're each other's oldest friend. I mean, that means we've been friends for 39 years now, which is pretty wild. Chris and I were in our first bands together. He played drums, I played guitar. We did AC/DC and then less latterly Nirvana covers. Didn't do Maiden because it was too hard. So we kind of grew up together. We sort of gone in different roads as we've got older. I went off and, you know, moved to London, did my punk rock thing and all the rest. And Chris is still a Hampshire boy. And Chris got deep into electronica and like the kind of the deranged edge of electronica, kind of Warp Records, Aphex Twin, you know, that sort of stuff, which I have a taste in, but he's like, not only is he buried in it, he kind of knows how to make that kind of music as well, which blows my mind. Yeah. And we've sort of been talking about doing a collaborative project for, I mean, literally decades. And we started working on what became the Eaten Before Swimming record, I think about 12 years before it came out. I started sending him kind of like vocal and guitar kind of covers of easy listening songs or 50s songs. I think initially it was going to be an Elvis covers thing, because we did Don't Be Cruel was the first song that we did. Ultimately, that felt a little restrictive, so we did stuff like Magic Moments and all the rest of it as well, and Singing in the Rain and Let's Face the Music and Dance. And I'll be honest, I mean, I think Chris takes the lion's share of the credit, certainly on the technical side of things. I would like send him material. He would then disappear for 6 months and then send me a track back again. And I would go, Jesus Christ.
Like, what have you done?
Yeah, well, are you all right? Is one of the questions that comes to mind. But yeah, so we eventually got it together and we put out volume one. We are working on a volume two. Which who knows, might take another 10 years, but we're talking about making a Christmas album. Which, you know, I mean, and like one of my least favorite songs of all time is Simply Having a Wonderful Christmas Time. I just think it's just an awful piece of music. So of course we're doing our own version of that.
Absolutely.
And some others as well. So we'll see.
Frank, did you realize, right, that there's only 365 days in the year, don't you? I've never seen someone who just is constantly creating all different ways, you know. And listen, we have a little chat about this. I want to talk to you about the Lost Thing things. The next one's happening. It's the 19th to the 22nd of September in Toronto. The 19th is an acoustic duo show, and someone called Henry Rollins is also going to be that one. I vaguely remember it. Oh, my God. Unbelievable.
Yeah.
You've also got a first five albums concentrated show, and that's going to be with Nobro, as we were talking. There's a punk rock set with the Dirty Nil. And then finally, a greatest hit set. And what I love about this is the support is Bedouin Soundclash. You know, it's just lovely that you do that. What was the idea of that? When did it come? And what was the first one? Where was the first one?
The first one was in Camden, and it was a bit of a Hail Mary experiment. And me and my crew, with the emphasis on my crew, sort of put a festival together without any real idea of how to do it. And it surprised everyone by working. And we were all just like, oh my God. I mean, it wasn't perfect. I remember on about an hour before doors on day one of Lost Evenings One, somebody went, we got any wristbands? And everyone went, fuck. And somebody got sent to a wristband to buy 12,000 wristbands or whatever it was. So, it was a bit skin of its teeth the first year. But the idea, I mean, a bunch of people were trying to talk to me about doing a festival or something. And I think for bands or acts that have a kind of longevity in their career, it makes sense to have your own kind of an annual event or whatever. It's quite a cool thing to do. So, I didn't want to do a festival. Beautiful Days exists. There's no point in me copying that. And Flog and Molly have their cruise, so I'm not going to do a cruise. And in the event, my friends in the band Wolf Alice did a thing on their first album. They could have done, I think, an arena headline show. They got big enough quickly, but they didn't want to do that because they're like, we've got one album and we're still kind of learning our chops. So instead, they did four nights at the Forum in London with different support acts of each night. And I went down and watched it, and I was standing with their manager watching it, and he said, yeah, it's kind of like a festival, this, isn't it? And I was like, yes, it is. And now put that thought out of your mind, and forget, you know, Jedi mind trick that shit away. So kind of took the idea and ran with it. And like, you know, the idea was always to move it around. We did a couple in Camden to start with. We went to Boston, we went to Berlin, we went to Anaheim, California, this year in Toronto, next year in Redacted. But let me tell you, I've got them mapped out for a good 3 or 4 years at the moment. Oh, so
that's amazing. It's so wonderful. Yeah. We previously have talked about your career. We talked about Million Dead and stuff like that. But what I want to do is to jump from the end of Million Dead and the way in which you went into being on your own with an acoustic guitar. Was that like a real mind fuck of a time in that it's so different having a band with you than being up there with an acoustic? What was that time like?
I mean, I find it quite weird thinking about it these days. I mean, the shorthand version of it is just say that, like, at the time I was very confident. I felt like I had a plan. I felt like I knew exactly what I was doing. And all my friends thought I was having some kind of psychotic episode. And like, I mean, people were, the doing an acoustic thing after being in a punk band thing has become a better trod path since then. I'm not claiming like, precedence or influence or whatever, but like, you know, at the time saying I've left a hardcore band, I'm going to do an acoustic record. People were really just kind of like, are you high? Like, what the fuck are you talking about? And then now looking back, all my friends think, oh, well, he must have had a plan. He must have known what he was doing. And I look back at it and I think, Christ alive, I must have been high. Like, I find it quite hard to kind of think myself back into that mindset. I mean, we're talking 17 years ago now. So, you know, 18 years ago, actually, now I think about it. Anyway, a long time ago. You know, I guess the one thing I would say that I'm kind of proud of is that the confidence with which I did it was very sort of artistically pure. Do you know what I mean? Like, it wasn't the commercial move at the time. It wasn't the expected move at the time. It wasn't what anyone thought I was going to do. It wasn't what anyone thought was a good idea. And I just sort of soldiered on with it and kept doing it for very little return at the beginning. I mean, the last Million Dead show, we played to 800 people. And the first solo show I did, I played to 2 people, both of whom were on the guest list. You know, like it was something of a blow to the ego. It definitely wasn't a money making sort of, scheme or whatever. And like, you know, it worked in the long run. It was sort of give or take. But
particular artists, Frank, that you had maybe seen that was a performer and an acoustic guitar that you'd seen and thought, do you know what? I like that. I'm inspired by that. Was there anything like that?
Yeah, there was. I mean, essentially because of my first love was made and my parents don't listen to modern music, like my knowledge of music was completely upside down. So I mean, for example, I was intimately familiar with the Minutemen song, Bob Dylan Writes Propaganda Songs, before I'd ever heard a single song by Bob Dylan. And, you know, I wasn't familiar with Bob Dylan, Neil Young, The Beatles, Bruce Springsteen, whatever sort of catalogue of classics you want to pull up. And discovering particularly the more kind of American rootsy side of that in my 20s whilst on tour in Million Dead was pretty revelatory for me. It's important also to cite Chuck Reagan. So Chuck was the singer in Hot Water Music, and Chuck did a kind of country record in, I think, 2006. And I had done a few acoustic shows at that point, but it was really kind of revelatory to me. It was like, oh, that fucking works, and it makes sense. And like, it was him and also a guy called Tim Barry from the band Avail started doing acoustic stuff around the same time. So they were definitely precedents that I was following.
It's funny as well. You talked about Nirvana earlier on, and you know, the Nirvana Unplugged thing that they did for MTV is one of those moments when you think, "Wow, this is totally different. I love these songs. I've loved them for years, but there's something completely new about them now." Sure. You know,
that's
wonderful.
The other version of that for me, actually, so the sidebar in my music career, aside from punk rock and metal and stuff, was my older sister was in stuff like Counting Crows and Soul Asylum and Weezer and stuff like that. And I got an acoustic guitar when I was a kid, and I couldn't really play Megadeth. I still can't. It's hard. But I could play Counting Crows songs. So I learned a bunch of these songs kind of for my sister's benefit, and we would sit around and play them around the campfire. Counting Crows always did B-sides with alternative arrangements of their songs. Like more acoustic, more folky arrangements of their songs. So really early doors, the idea that a song can be dressed up in more than one way was kind of was introduced to my repertoire, if you like.
Yeah. That's interesting. And did you find that, like, I mean, we had one of our podcasts with Ricky Warwick, who went on to play with And he was saying that, you know, he was used to the electric band, and then all of a sudden he went acoustic just on his own. He was talking to the to Def Leppard about it. He says, right, open for us. And he's going, what?
Yeah. Incidentally, it should be said that as a kid, I used to play drums along to Almighty Records in my mate's bedroom. Awesome band. Yeah.
You find, because, I mean, obviously when it's a small audience, you're there, it's personal, you know, but suddenly doing that in a big arena or a big space, that's a different world. I mean, how do you find that comparison, you know?
It was challenging. And like, you know, if you're playing completely solo, which I did for the first, let's say, 3 years of my career before there was a band in play, which I still do, there is something, you know, you are the sole thing making noise. You can't blame it on the drummer when it goes wrong, and you can't, you know, do an extended noise solo or dive into the crowd or any of this sort of stuff. It's very, very raw and kind of naked. That was kind of part of the appeal to me in a way, in the sense that felt that there was something really punk about stripping away all possible artifice. You know, it's just a good song.
You didn't find it daunting?
Oh yeah. No, completely. 100%. The early shows I did, you know, I'm not 100% convinced they were all that good for a start. You know what I mean? But like, I used to ramble quite a lot and all this kind of thing. And as you say, I mean, I got to a point, I did a tour opening for The Automatic, actually took me out early doors. Biffy Clyro took me out as well. And yeah, you know, if the part of the conceit of playing solo is that you're kind of recreating a campfire sing along or whatever, it's really not that when you're playing at the Roundhouse or something. You know what I mean? So yeah, it was scary. But I mean, again, we go back then to what I was mentioning earlier, that kind of like almost kamikaze confidence that I had at the time, which I now find quite difficult to kind of parse and to think my way back inside of, but which I'm sort of proud of as well.
Record Store Day is April the 20th. And you, sir, this year are going, well, I know that I'll be having to head to Crash Records in Leeds very early in the morning to get a copy of the special 7-inch Girl from the Record Shop. And I just wanted you to tell us a little bit about that song and what Record Store Day means to you.
So the song, there was a moment in time in this record. I quite often do this in the process of writing a record. I have a moment when it's going to be a concept album and then it isn't, and everyone breathes a sigh of relief. But there was a sort of concept that I was dealing with about kind of a conversation between me and my 15-year-old self, because that is a thing that I sort of do in my quiet moments, and it's not very healthy psychologically and blah, blah, blah. But it's a sort of true story slash slightly fantasized version of essentially falling in love with somebody, at a distance, in the way that teenage boys do, with a girl who works in a record shop because she was so evidently cooler and more knowledgeable than I was. And I just sort of go and hang around and try and think of what records I could ask to listen to that would make her not think I was a worm. And obviously failed in my endeavors, of course. And I'm not even sure that she was aware of my existence in any way, but now it's a song, which my wife does not like. I finished the song and I played it to her, and my wife was like, I don't like any of those bands. And I was like, yeah, that's fair enough. So it's a bit of a flight of kind of teenage fancy, but it's also ultimately it's a paean to the record shop as well. And record shops were really important to me as a kid. And I think they're still important now in a different way, which we'll come to, but it's the socialization part of it. It's the fact that, you know, I didn't really know that many people who liked the same kind of music I did. I felt very isolated being a kid who was into weirdo underground punk rock alternative music. And going to underground gigs, festivals, and particularly record shops as a kid was this hugely validating moment. It's like, oh my God, there's other people. I'm not doing this completely on my own. You know, I was the kind of kid who'd read books about the history of punk rock, but not know any punks kind of thing. And then you go to a record shop and there's someone wearing a Riot Girl t-shirt and you're kind of like, ah, I know what that is. And like, maybe we could have a conversation, or maybe I'll just stand over here and stare at you for 2 straight years. whatever it might be. But like, so, you know, it's not just discovering new music, it's discovering a social circle as well. And sort of that I think is hugely important. It was hugely important to me as a kid. There was an indie record store in Winchester when I was a kid who knew if anything with Fat Records or Epitaph came in, the guy would put it aside and just wait for me to come in and then essentially blackmail me into buying it, which I would.
Brilliant.
Yeah,
It's Frank, I swear to God, you're like, I mean, you've done an awful lot more than me, but honestly, those formative years, it seems so similar, but it's that thing, isn't it? of a young lad. When you discover, it's, you know, some people are into their cricket, some people are into art or whatever. But when you find music, oh my God, it's like you find that friend.
Totally. And there's nothing else has ever come close to me in terms of, you know, I don't follow sports teams. I don't care about that or whatever. Happy days if people do. But like, there's a purity of connection to it, which remains everything it was. For Valentine's Day, just gone, my wife bought me a copy of the first Fugazi album on vinyl, which I did not own before. And the great thing about vinyl, as we all know, is that it makes you concentrate harder on the music. And I just like, I was like, thanks, babe. See you in 45 minutes. And just went and like... put it on and just had a lovely time immersing myself in a record that I know back to front, upside down. Like, I can't tell you how familiar with every single note on that, every Fugazi record I am. And it was just a lovely, lovely thing. And it, you know, that connection is still as pure as it was on day one.
I promise you this is going to be our last question, Frank, because literally we could do a Frank Turner mini series because there's so much I was talking. But the last thing I want to talk is that you have written the Road Beneath My Feet. You've also written Try This at Home, Adventures in Songwriting. And I'm wondering, when you look back at your career, okay, can you believe at how much you've done?
No, it's fucking ridiculous. And like, I genuinely spend most of my days waiting for a knock on the door in the middle of the night from the reality police telling me that there's been a terrible mistake. And this was all for someone else. You know, I'm so grateful for what I have and what I've been able to do with my life. And, you know, hopefully we're talking, this is a mid-career conversation, I'd like to think. So there's more coming. But like, you know, even if the whole thing goes away tomorrow and the reality police do set up, I've been incredibly privileged to do the things that I've done. And is in a way, part of my kind of hyperactivity, such as it is kind of related to this in the sense that it's just kind of like, you know, I'm in a position right now. I am kind of very vaguely toying with the idea for another book. And it's like, if I come up with an idea for a book, somebody's going to publish it. And like, that's fucking incredible. And therefore I probably should. You know what I mean? And like, I should take advantage of that. If I write songs, people are going to give me money to record them and then allow me to tour them around the world. Fuck me. Get on with it. Do you know what I mean? Like, what a fortune to have in life. So, yeah, hopefully there's more coming, but I'm a grateful person. I think gratitude is a really, really excellent emotion to try and kind of engage with in life. And I do my best to do that.
Well, Frank, we've run out of time. I just want to say from myself and Ben, thank you so much, Mr. Frank Turner, for sharing your Splash story with us, and very, very good luck with the album.
Thank you so much, man. It's always a pleasure chatting, and love to chat to you, Ben.
Cheers. All the best to you. Good luck with the tour.
Thank you very much.
Please get in touch with us at splashclubtv@gmail.com and see us on the Facebook, facebook.com/thesplashclub. Have a great day.